Okay, as I said, I'm with the Florida Folk Life Programs. And we're
Folk
doing,
Life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're doing a survey of southwestern Florida and to look at, among other things, the agriculture in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that you've been doing, you've been in the agriculture business for quite a long time.
Longer than I care to remember.
How did you get started in it?
When I came out of the Navy, and I think it was 1946, my father was in the farming,
mm-hmm.
and so I came out and started farming. I was a watermelon grower primarily at that time, and so it just kind of evolved into this. But as a watermelon grower for quite a few years, then, of course, everybody tries to have the first watermelons and because they get the most money for the earlier ones. This was a long time ago, of course, when we loaded them in boxcars. And so we ended up hunting warmer climates a little further south.
Where did you start out?
In the Leesburg, about halfway between Leesburg and DeLand, a little place called Altoona.
Mm-hmm.
And we had among the earlier watermelons every year. And I went to Massart Town, south of Brooksville, for 1 year before I came here, going a little further south. And, of course, the watermelon belt wasn't that big at that time either. You know, I went from some areas of Polk County north, you know, really. But that's how I came to be down here, just hunting a warmer place to grow watermelon and get them in earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Walked into the middle of a winter vegetable growing area, really, what it amounts to.
Uh-huh. And so, has this always been a big growing area? I understand that that it used to be that a little bit farther south was the main growing area, and it has moved up to Immokalee.
I suppose that's partly true because Homestead, they've been growing down there for years, mainly because they have a rock land down there. Red lands and rock lands, they call it. And when I came up here, in 1951, about the only farming they were doing was wildcat farming. They didn't clear a lot of land. They farmed the flat sloughs. You know, they didn't have any trees, or if they had a palmetto patch or a few trees, they just farmed around them.
And that's what's called wildcat farming? When
yeah,
they don't
we call
clear
it wildcat, it? Just like a wildcat oil well driller, you know, they're just out hunting something. And these people farm like that because, to give you a better example of what they did a few years before I got here, but not too long, I think that was in World War II, the earlier part. Mr. Jimmy Toop is dead now, of course, and they used to farm a little field of cucumbers, and they put their ditch around it to get the water off of it with a shovel, dug a little ditch around it. Now you see big dragline ditches and backhoe ditches around these farms. So it was always been a little matter of water control in here. It was flat country. And then they started farming around in the sloughs without any dikes and all, just because of kind of wildcat farming, you know. And then about the time I came here, they started clearing up these palmetto flats. They had to adapt to because they had to learn that land was sour, and they had to put soil condition on it, you know. There was a few crop losses because of that, because it didn't get the soil condition right. It took a few years to learn how to do that. And then, of course, I was still just watermelons then, and tomato growers, and some big tomato growers around, like Roy Miller and Zico and Dewey Bethea and people like that. And all of those people have since died, you know, they're gone. So we've evolved to kind of a scientific type farming almost now, you know. It got to be a combination of everything now.
When did you branch out from watermelons to tomatoes and cucumbers and peppers?
Personally, I did in 1961. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I started to grow some pepper then. And I liked it. It was a good crop. And it intrigued me somewhat. I enjoy growing pepper. It's very slow to react. It's almost like an orange tree, which I do orange tree farming also, but it's almost like an orange tree. If you let pepper get to the point where it shows you a need or a hunger, it's, you've almost waited too late. You've got to anticipate. So other things like cucumbers and tomatoes, they may respond so fast that you can almost get one in trouble and get it out, you know. But I'm predominantly pepper. And well, since I've merged with my son and my brother-in-law this past year, well, then I guess our most acreage is in tomatoes now. Mm-hmm. It's a good crop too, tomatoes.
How do you see Collier County farming as different from farming anywhere else in Florida?
I think it's very unique. The only place that's similar to it would be the east coast of Florida, around the Delray Beach area. I think, as I said, we do several types of irrigation. We do the seepage irrigation. We have perimeter ditches to drain our water out, and cross ditches and laterals and the like to get the water to those perimeter ditches. There are a few, as opposed to give you one other area, Homestead, they got this very porous rock. And they can stick a 10-foot hole or so in the rock there and put a pipe in it. And they got a well. They pump out of it. North of us, we get on more rolling soil, Wachula area, and Arcadia Farms a little bit like us, but they're on more rolling ground. They're similar to us, though, however, getting more similar all the time because we're starting to use the plastic on the beds. But it is very different. When I came down here, I had never seen a high crop tractor. I understand that this place and cane growers in Louisiana, I believe, were the only two places John Deere, for instance, sold high crop tractors.
What's the difference in a regular tractor and a high crop tractor?
A row crop is one with the axle just go out of the rear and go straight out. It's lower. Uh-huh. The high crop has got, it's built up a little bit and it straddles these beds, and the plants are on top of beds, mm-hmm. So they have to have about 3 foot clearance, you know.
So they won't hit the plants.
So they won't hit the plants. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a high crop tractor, mm-hmm. As opposed to, for instance, an orchard type or a tractor like you see mowing on the side of the road or something. They're all low tractors, mm-hmm. Low crop. Mm-hmm. And so the types of irrigation. I think the biggest change from when I came here, if you're interested in that, is the water control, because every year you have something happen to you, you put that in your little book of knowledge in the back of your brain somewhere and try to draw on it and use it from time to time. A lot of people are damaged by too much water. And when I first came here, we had like motor grader ditches, for instance. And a motor grader doesn't cut a very deep ditch. It looked pretty big. And we got along with it. And then there was a few of the big farmers that had drag line ditches.
And the drag line ditch is?
It's bigger and deeper and everything. And as you progressed on, you realized you had too much money in a crop. You had to protect it the best you could. So you had to go to better drainage. And you figure out better ways to irrigate. And of course, it stayed the same for a long time. We come into this Rainbird thing, the overhead irrigation with portable Rainbirds, the 3-point hitch mounted on the back of these tractors. A lot of people use them for a while. Very aggravating. But a lot of people use them.
Why were they aggravating?
Well, they're hard to keep them primed. They're aggravating to work them. Mm-hmm. And they really are, take my word for it. People, as soon as they could get away from them, they did.
Why went, and I don't know anything about agriculture, so this will seem a
sure.
dumb question.
No problem.
Why would you use a Rainbird irrigator or an overhead irrigator when the main problem is water control?
Well, because as wet as it gets down here through a good part of the year, it also gets very dry. To give an example, the first year I came down here, I thought I'd come to the end of the world. I came down here to deliver some equipment down here, and I came in on Monday night. It had rained Monday, and Monday night and Tuesday rained 16 inches in the middle of October. All these flat woods out here had a foot and a half of water on them, just underwater totally. We had to roll up the pass leg, come out in that one motel in Mockbee, get in the truck. It didn't rain anymore for 4 months. It quit raining. That was the last rain. It didn't rain for a long time. And then it was terribly dry. But you have to have water for getting seed up. Even if you have moisture, you got to get your seed up and seal in your young plants if you put out plants. So that's why the overhead. But now with the new deal on plastic, we have a little bit better ways of doing it. We have water wagons, for instance, that we plant a plant out or put seed in the hole through the plastic or whichever, and then run water wagon once or twice, and then that's it.
That seals in the moisture then?
More or less. It more or less seals the dirt around the plant. Yeah, mm-hmm. More or less. Mm-hmm. You don't have to continue to run the water wagon all the time. But you do run it, you know, time or two. Mm-hmm. But I think the biggest single change has to be the plastic mulch on the bed. It's made good farmers out of mediocre farmers. Mm-hmm. It really has. A lot of people fought it for a little while and thought they couldn't afford it. But what they found out, they couldn't afford not to have it, mm-hmm. because of the weed control, and it actually uses somewhat less fertilizer. You still have to, if you have your plastic laid while you're waiting for your fumigants and things to dissipate enough to put your plants out, you mm-hmm. still have to protect it as though it had plants on it. Mm-hmm. If water gets over those beds or gets too dry or whatever, you gotta take care of it just as though it had crop on it, which is usually about 3 or 4 weeks. And it makes a fine way to grow. It really does. It makes a pretty field. And if you have a rain, you don't have to come back and rebuild your beds over again like we did with pepper back. The open ground farming with pepper was very meticulous. We had specialized equipment to work as close as we could to the plant without damaging it in order for the weed control, because it grows so slow you had to have good weed control.
Mm-hmm. What makes a pretty field?
Plastic.
But when you look at it, what to you makes it pretty? I mean,
it's different. It's smooth. The rows are so straight. Now we've gone into, we don't do one row at a time anymore. Most of us do, some people do, but most of us use 3-row equipment. We make 3 beds, we fertilize 3 beds, we lay plastic on 3 beds, we plant 3 beds at one time with planters, and in the case of pepper, where you have two rows on a bed, we actually plant 6 rows, but it's all on that 3-bed. So it's all in unison as it goes down, and it has something to do with your spray machine. Then everything we do is 3. Uh-huh. So if you make a bobble here, the next machine will make the same bobble. Uh-huh. If you got one, they're going kind of like this, you know, and there's one. Uh-huh. It makes a beautiful feel if you've had occasion to see any of them, as opposed to just plain ground bedded up. Uh-huh. Very unique. I think they're doing a little bit of plastic farming in South Carolina, but they have to approach it a different way. They either use a drip irrigation under the plastic, because they're not as level as we are, and they don't have that way of doing the seepage irrigation. Homestead, for instance, they lay their plastic, plant their plants, but they have a lot of holes punched in their plastic on top of the bed. Then they do their overhead irrigation and let it drip down through the holes to water the plants.
But here you just have the seed holes, is that it?
Have the seed holes, that's all. And the water goes out. It goes down from our wells, it goes down to a little hard pan about 30 inches down there, spreads out more or less, and the capillary action in the soil kind of holds and lifts the moisture up under the plants. Mm-hmm. And of course, that works fine, but you always need a little natural rainfall every now and then, and it still helps a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. Then we use a herbicide between the rows. That's what makes it pretty. Use a herbicide between the beds to keep the weeds clean. Mm-hmm. And I think most people would be interested and shocked. I'm talking about people up north in Miami and downtown Naples and everywhere else, if they really knew what all was involved to lay a pepper on their table or a tomato on their table. Mm-hmm. Whenever these warehouses for the chain stores order produce, we just don't go out and plug in our machine and make them. It's a machine that's been going for about 8 or 9 months, not 8 or 9 months, the whole year really, but it takes about from 75 to 120 days to make most of our crops after we put plants out, depending on what it is. And probably the fastest thing we have is squash or cucumbers.
Mm-hmm.
Warm weather, they'll make in 45 or 50 days. But everything else, tomatoes and pepper. Tomatoes and pepper generally are, oh, say 100 days, and it can be up to 120. It can be a little less than that too.
What's the thing that stayed the same the most? I mean, the thing that's been consistent over the whole time that you've been farming, what with all these other changes that have come along?
Still trying to get credit from your fertilizer people. That's always the same. I like to say if it was easy, everybody would want to do it. It's not that. It's not simple. Nothing's simple anymore. I think we've seen the little small farmer in Immokalee go by the wayside. They're still in some areas, but not really here. Land is getting harder to get. There's more land being taken up for orange grove.
How do you feel about that?
Well, mixed emotions. I have orange grove. We have 600 acres of grove up on Highway 31. I got 160 bearing grove out here out east of town. We have a citrus packing house next door that we're running. So I think it's a good thing. But I guess my first love is vegetables. I've been in a long time. And I've been doing our own packing in the packing house for the last 10 years. And feel like that's kind of important. If you grow enough packages to warrant a packing house, then I think it's very important. Otherwise, it's hard to kind of control your destiny like you should or something like that. And I think it's a good help.
Do you think it takes a special kind of person to be a farmer, to be in agriculture?
Well, I think it does, especially in this area. I can't tell you how many people has told me, and I'm sure all the other farmers hear the same thing. How in the world do you sleep at night? My God, how do you sleep at night? You know, everybody works on borrowed money. Nobody can sit around and, if you try to work on a cash basis, my God, Uncle Sam would eat you up, and first thing you know, you wouldn't have any money left. So you have to invest in other things and work on credit. And you'll have, it depends on the size, and everything's relative. So what I might say about one farm, $100,000 might be a big deal to one guy. It may take $1 million to be a big deal to another guy. But whatever it is, we have the money in the field, and it's all hinging on the weather. The weather could come along and absolutely drown you out and wipe that out. There's no way to recover that. That's the good part of the plastic. The plastic farming, you can, if you got drowned out, you can come back anymore with a few new inventions and take the old plants off the plastic. We have some wheels we've designed with a little pressure that will force and punch a little hole and force liquid fertilizer in the beds and kind of put another crop on that during that year. You can't do it next year very well, but you can this year. You know, we call that double cropping. So,
and that's in the event of a big rain?
Oh, whatever. It also can be used when we have a crop sack, and not tomatoes that we're picking now. When we finish and those tomatoes, the quality is gone after two or three pickings or four, whatever, maybe we'll go in and pull those stakes, cut those tomato plants off, but leave the plastic intact, plant watermelon plants there, spray them with something that systemic product that will keep the nematodes off the roots, inject liquid fertilizer and grow a crop of watermelons on for the spring.
Mm-hmm.
That's double cropping.
Mm-hmm.
So it can work both ways. But I think that it does take a special person because you have to be able to keep your sanity while you got everything on the line out there. A lot of borrowed money, everything you own, and you know, and plus whatever money is borrowed, and you know, in our particular operation, it's not uncommon for us to have a couple $1 million out there before we get anything back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's bad. It's bad in a way, but it's not a staple crop. The potential is there for good returns, as such as tomatoes this fall, for instance. Mm-hmm. We had a natural shortage of tomatoes for some reason all over the United States. So we would have had a decent price this fall, but we got this storm that came through and caused some damage. Then we had about 8 inches of rain came through here about 2 weeks ago. That damaged some fields pretty bad. So we were getting, I think, $17 for the best grade of tomatoes. And so our return back per acre was great, although some people's yields were low. Uh-huh. My particular yield happened to be pretty good. And so, you know, you have to have these high spots to go along with all the low spots to make it average out. That's what I'm talking about. That's what makes the farmer keep his sanity a little bit. I look back at my history, and since I started farming in 1946, and the averages is what keeps me in it. I've been able to kind of be fairly consistent and have some weak years and some good years and some sort of so-so years, kind of break even, this kind of thing. And so I think that's, I think you see some people, very wealthy people, that get in a little business and have $10,000 invested and they worry like the devil about it, you know. And because that's their level of worry. Uh-huh. A guy here, if he's got 10 acres, or if he's got 1,000 in 10 acres, one worry is the same. It doesn't make any difference.
Right.
Same worry. Everything being relative again.
You said that this past year you merged with your brother-in-law and your son?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So your son's in farming too?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Was there ever any question that that's what he'd do?
I don't think so. I think when he was, before he was a teenager, when he was under 9 years old, people would ask him, what are you going to do? He said, grow watermelons. That was what my profession was, grow watermelons. And so, but he's involved in it, and he's the president of our corporation now, and kind of the manager of the three places, and I'm trying to slow down a little bit, but not hardly. I don't doubt there's any, I don't think there's any doubt about what he's going to do.
I see several helicopters around here. What are those for?
To play with. People say, can you justify that helicopter? Or does it save you a lot of time? I said, I bought mine to play with. And I really did. But the little helicopter, the little one you see there,
uh-huh.
We're giving instruction in. I have a little helicopter school.
Uh-huh.
And I have an instructor giving instruction. And the others, there's two of those. 500, one belongs to my son, one belongs to me.
Uh-huh.
We could get by with one, but I wanted one. And he's got one. We treat him like a personal vehicle.
Uh-huh.
We got that grove this side of Arcadia. I got a grove out here about 30 miles out east.
Uh-huh.
I have to go through several gates to get to. I got cattle out there. I use it to work my cattle, to gather them with, to oversee them. And so that's what helicopter's for.
What? How did you get into cattle?
Hmm?
How did you get into cattle?
I've had a few cows a good many years ago. I had a little land up where I came from, but I bought a couple of 2,000 acres of land here about 8 to 10 years ago. And of course, when you have grass, you just use cattle as a byproduct of your grass. If you have the grass, you don't want to waste it, so you have cattle. I'm present in a Beefmaster breed on an upgrading program. I've used purebred Beefmaster bull now for the last 7 or 8 years, and I've been able to work it into a purebred herd. Run about 400 cattle, 400 mama cows and brood cows.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what they call a cow-calf operation. We breed by season. The bulls are out of the cattle now. We put them out 1st of January. And leave them out till June. And the calves drop in from the 1st of October on up to about March maybe, and then they don't drop when they're little bitty calves out there in the deep water and the mosquitoes in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
However, the deep water and mosquitoes now, this is unusual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And anyway, cows are just a sideline, and they're, if you have a way to get into it, it kind of complements the farming a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can do it. For instance, I farm out there on some of these fields, then I turn the cattle into the farm field after we finish. The grass and stuff is fertilized so well till, I don't know how to say it, except maybe one bite of that's worth three bites of this regular range grass.
Uh-huh. You know, it's real good for them.
It's strong, sure is. And the calves are very evident of that. You can get the ones off there that we bring them to the cow pens, the ones with the come off the farm field, the cattle are just as fat and slick as they can be.
So they bring a good price.
Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. I think you've